Welcome back, everybody, to Galazzo, which today is looking back on one of Calcio's most unique figures, a revolutionary on and off the pitch, Zdeněk Zeman, a man whose teams scored and conceded more goals than he's had drags on cigarettes. A man who wasn't afraid to take on the most powerful figures in football. Join us then on this journey into Zemanlandia. Wow, wouldn't it be great to have people chanting our name as we walk into the Golazzo studio, A. Gab Marcotti?
A bit like in professional wrestling.
Very much so. We could adopt names and costumes as well. James Horncastle, you're already hard at work on that.
Yep, I have got my leotard on.
Horny pirate, arr! How the crowd would roar. Anyway, hey, now, today we're all about rhapsodising about the Bohemian. A man who said, sometimes the losers, takes a drag on cigarette, have taught more than the winners. I like to think I've given something more and something different to football. What a Zeman quote that is. Why is he so special? Why is he so beloved, James Horncastle?
He was always an outsider. I think there's always been a resistance to, not necessarily foreign coaches, but people who have certainly very different ideas in Italy, and he's always stood out because of that. And he was very countercultural, I think, in coming in and basically saying, you guys have kind of got it all wrong. You know, you focus too much on the wrong things, which are, you know, the result. When in actual fact, basically, you know, what people come to the stadium for is to be entertained, and that's what I want to do. And, you know, the results should not be everything.
Even when he was part of the mainstream, mid-90s, when he went to Lazio and then Roma, and he was in the thick of the title battle, he then made himself an outsider again by calling out Juventus and sparking what at the time was one of their biggest scandals in years.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he was the first person to go and talk about Juventus's use of pharmaceutical enhancements, legal pharmaceutical enhancements, and then you get into a whole hornet's nest. I mean, it's important to know, I think, that, you know, ultimately they weren't found guilty, although then later, because there's a whole bunch of different trials and there were some issues about improper assumption of drugs and whatever else, but that's a whole hornet's nest there. But he was basically, you know, he was very explicit about it. And I think one of the things his critics would say is, you know, yeah, it's very easy to cast yourself as the guy who's, you know, stand against power and so on, because you know you're always going to get the protest vote, you know?
Beyond all that stuff, which we'll talk about later and the impact that had both on it, the Italian game and on him, but the biggest thing he did was his football, the 4-3-3 and... Do you know, it's funny, when he returned to Roma more recently, and I think this happens most times he joins a club, everyone goes, yeah, Zeman's back. Even though when you actually look at it, this is a manager who's been going for 40 years and has never won anything, nor had a sustained period of success. I think probably apart from maybe Foggia.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, people say you're a dinosaur, you don't change, you know, your ideas are completely out of date. And his response to that is, no, you guys are wrong. My ideas are about 15 years ahead of our time. So you'll eventually see it. Amid all the kind of controversies that he ended up being sort of wound up in, during his time at Roma in 99, he basically was approached, I think, by Real Madrid. And yeah, he was told, no, you're staying here. And then, 6 months later, he was out on his ass because of the comments he'd made about Juventus.
Whatever else you think about it, you know, people always exist in a certain context. And I think what he did, I'm speaking just about the football more than like the iconoclasm or whatever. So for those who don't know, I'm going to try to wrap this up in a nutshell, but he's basically, it was a 4-3-3 where the back four played a very high line, where you had one of the three central midfielders who sat a little bit deeper. And as Roberto Di Matteo famously said, who played that position for him, his job was you always had to move the ball first time. So you got the ball to circulate quickly.
And you'd be fined if you didn't.
And you'd be, yeah, I don't know if he was fined, but, you know, he said that he was. And you'd had, it's, you know, when we think of 4-3-3, it's two wingers and a striker. With Zeman, it wasn't two wingers and a striker. It was three dudes who were in the penalty box. It was basically three center forwards. And then the width came from the fullbacks who had to go, and but not just the fullbacks, but also the other two central midfielders. And, you know, I watched Manchester City today, and they have better players, a better coach, and obviously they have wingers. But, you know, some of these concepts in terms of the high line, in terms of flooding the area, in terms of the two sort of inside left and inside right, you know, often overlapping on the wings and them delivering the cross. There are a lot of concepts that we see today he had pushed back then, as well as the other thing which everybody complained about was the overtraining. Right?
Right.
He believed that, you know, we've only kind of tapped the surface. And why do footballers train for an hour and a half, three times a week, four times a week, because the rest are walkthroughs and travel? You know, surely if they trained, you know, like middle distance runners, then they'd be even better and they'd be more athletic. And then if you run faster, you win games. So all these ideas were there. The problem was Italian football in the 1990s was probably the worst possible place to go and implement it.
Although in some ways, because nobody else was doing it, it was almost the ideal scenario for him to enjoy success with that kind of fast-paced attacking football.
I think certainly on with Foggia it was, but the problem with Italian football back then was, A, you had, you know, once you moved to Lazio Roma, is A, you had a strength and depth that, you know, doesn't exist in major leagues today, didn't exist in major leagues back then. But most of all, we have this Italian disease, right? Where, for whatever reason, we don't think of, oh, look, I'm keeping a high line, I'm keeping possession in the opponent's half, and that means because I'm doing that, the opposition's not able to shoot on goal, right? All we think about is, oh, look, because I kept a high line, the defender didn't catch the guy, and we you know, we gave up a goal on the counter. We're always much more comfortable with the guy parking the bus and the whole sort of, like, you know, Chiellini stretching and the goalkeeper and these heroic defenses. And we think that that's an intelligent way to play. It's okay to concede goals, you know, se la difesa schierata, because, hey, look, you know, you were there, right? And that's anathema in the world, in the modern game. It just doesn't work today.
Maybe that's why Zeman is such a popular
ahead of
figure.
His time, yeah.
Well, yeah, also because he kind of represents another ideal, a more romantic way of doing things.
But it's not, see, I'm sorry, but people have said this about Pep too. It's not romantic. It works better.
In Zeman's case, maybe it is romantic, because will it ever actually work? Could it ever actually work? Well, we'll talk about that maybe, but let's start off by heading all the way back to the early 90s and Foggia.
Ci vuole un fisico bestiale per resistere agli urti della vita. Ma quel che leggi sul giornale e certe volte anche alla sfiga.
Sounds of Luca Carboni with Ci vuole un fisico bestiale. You need an animal physique, which is curiously appropriate, you know, riding high in the charts in 92. Zeman, who's, okay, nephew of a former Juventus manager.
That's quite an interesting point in and of itself.
Okay.
Because, of course, he is perceived to be the great enemy of Juventus. And in fact, you know, he was a Juventus sympathiser at the very least when he moved from what was then Czechoslovakia to go and live with his uncle in Palermo, who's his uncle who won the league title twice as a Juventus manager.
So he's growing up there in Palermo, tries a bit of football, prefers handball, which some people feel maybe influenced him tactically, but is a massive student of sports medicine and the whole area of looking at physically what footballers are capable of. He goes through various moves, and we can go into enormous detail if you want about how he begins, including taking over from Arrigo Sacchi, who just left to join Milan, taking over from him at Parma and lasting all of, I think, 7 matches.
Although he did knock out Sacchi's Milan from the Coppa Italia. I think he beat Real Madrid in a friendly as well in that brief period.
Extraordinary, and yet they still got rid of him.
Yeah, well, you know.
So he returns to Foggia, who at the time were down in the third division, where he begins this union with reignites this union with the owner, Pasquale Cassio, and particularly the man in charge of bringing in players, Beppe Pavoni, and a team that rises from the third division to Serie A, and in the 91-92 season, completely rips up the rule book, I think, Gabriele, is that fair, of what people think they're going to see in a Serie A match?
Yeah, because it really was so different. He had this, when I went to see him a couple years ago in Rome, he talked about one of his favorite players, and I was expecting that, you know, he's had a fair few good ones, but he mentions a guy named Liszt, who he was a fullback. You know, he said "lanciava se stesso," you know, which basically means he would effectively give himself an assist. And the reality was that this guy would just get the ball from the keeper or from the center backs, just look up the wing and just knock the ball 30 yards up the touchline to nobody, because, as we said, the strikers played inside in the Zeman system, and he would just kind of run past everybody and get there first. And it seems so stupid, right? You know, well, why doesn't Leroy Sané do that all the time? And the reason was because the way Italian football was back then, it was very simple. He explained this very well. He had his three strikers all go into the penalty box. And so what happens is the opposing fullbacks are like, uh-oh, danger, must follow striker inside. And all of a sudden, they're all really narrow. And all this guy has to do is just boot the ball 30, 40 yards. And he's faster than the winger who's tracking him. And he just runs past everybody. And he did that time and again.
Well, I wasn't expecting that player. You had, as you say, so many other great names, quite a few of whom left after that first season in Serie A. You had the likes of Shalimov, Francesco Delano, Dan Petrescu was there. Dan Petrescu.
Yeah, we should mention that first year they did finish with the second. They were the second top scorers in the league a newly promoted side.
58 goals scored.
Yeah.
How many had they conceded, James?
58
as well. And they had some remarkable results along the way and flirted with European places, which must have been an absolute revelation for anyone watching. This was the year before we started the Channel 4 coverage. And as we arrived, the big thing was the way that season ended, because while there were highs, there were always lows with Zeman. And the final game of the season, they were 2-1 up at home to Milan, but ended up losing 8-2. At the Zaccaria. But anyway, it was already, the narrative was already the Foggia dei Miracoli, the miraculous Foggia, and what people were calling Zemanlandia, which was this weird alternative world where the result was entirely inconsequential, but it was all about this system that Gabriele was talking about, the 4-3-3.
Yeah, and you talk about the kind of cultural impact of this team and the manager himself, and that it's been the kind of subject of films, plays, seem to remember Frengo, you know, on
My Dinner. Yeah. Oh, eh? Poco dopo.
Which, again, sort of just to transmit the emotions of following that team, really.
Yeah, he was, a cult figure.
Yeah.
And it was almost a cult of 4-3-3.
Mm.
A notable Venditti song as well, which we would play a bit of, it, except it sounds like this. Il palazzo risponde con
You know, Gab was telling us about the player that Zeman thought of as one of his favourites. I mean, many people were just associating with the subject of this pod a few weeks ago. It's just Beppe Signori. You know, Signori had, I think, went from what, playing with Piacenza, and he scored five goals the year before he met Zeman, of which three were penalties, and then becomes, you know, one of the most prolific strikers that the game has known in Italy. Also, again, this passed me by as well, but he had a year with Messina where he had Toto Schillaci. And again, Schillaci had done hardly anything and all of a sudden becomes top scorer in the second division and gets that move to Juve. And then Le Notte Magiche, you know, the Italian 90. So sounds like he was a lot of fun to work with if you were a striker.
And if you didn't mind repeatedly running up the steps of the stands.
Mm.
I have to say, I don't know if you guys had this when you guys spoke to him, but what's really difficult, because when you interview somebody, you know, it's over a cup of coffee, having a conversation, you never know when he's finished speaking.
No. It's really
long silence. Yeah. And then you ask to say your next thing, and then he starts talking while you're talking, and he's finishing or adding to whatever. You know, it's really, really unnerving.
No, his speaking style is as distinctive as his football was.
Yeah, one of the things that I found interesting when I spoke to him, and again, this was when he was at Roma, was that he would get... The strikers would know exactly which run to make according to the foot with which the midfielder went to play the ball.
Hmm.
And so it completely kind of minimised their kind of thinking time, in that all they had to do was just pay a little... If Di Francesco, for example, is about to play on his left foot, the striker, Del Vecchio, whoever it was, knew one of three runs to make. If it was with his right foot, it was, again, something else entirely, which is, yeah, I would say pretty damn sophisticated.
Well, you spoke to Di Francesco this week,
yeah,
about the Champions League and stuff, but did you asked him about Zeman. Did he have happy memories of the Bohemian?
Yeah, I mean, he says that Zeman is the biggest influence on his career. He not only is very associated with 4-3-3, but playing vertical all the time, you know, playing it as quickly as possible, forward as quickly as possible. But he's also someone that I think is, you know, does not want to be stereotyped as someone who is just one of Zeman's children, in that, you know, for all the innovations that he had, this idea that you're a team that is, you know, flaky at the back, you can concede a lot of goals. And I remember Di Francesco's one of the, you know, on the eve of the season, they played Celta Vigo in a friendly and they were 3-0 down at half time. And, you know, here's another guy, he's just another one of Zeman's prodigies, you know. And the reality is that over the course of the season, what have we seen? Roma with 17 clean sheets, in some respects, you know, would debunk that. It was great to be a midfield player, but did hardly any work defensively in the team. It was just all about the schemes that we would implement in attack, and that was it.
Well, it made it glorious to watch. So 92-93 then, they'd sold off Shalimov and Delano for a ridiculous sum of money each to Inter. And they brought in...
Who else? I mean, seriously, who else?
Brian Roy had arrived.
Yeah.
And Gigi Di Biagio, future Italy manager Gigi Di Biagio, was there. The season did not start well. They lost their first three. There was a crazy scenes when the ultras broke into the stadium and smashed the place up and left signs saying Casillo Vattene. And they were third last in December. Sorry, fourth last in December when Juventus came to the Zaccaria. Juve at the time were third and were Juventus, as they remain to this day, of course. But they ended up 2-1 losers that day. When you look through the team sheet for the Juve, I mean, that was classic. Trapattoni come back from Inter. You had Puruzzi in goal. You had your friend Gianluca Vialli up front. Gigi Casiraghi alongside him. Kula in defence. Andreas Möller was there. I mean, ridiculous side. That was the moment the Zemelandia hit the mainstream. Of course, that season also saw them lose 6-2 against Fiorentina on the final day of the season. But kind of whatever, that was all part of the ride. 93-94, Signori then made his big move north to Lazio.
Think of how much money this guy made his club.
Castillo, I mean, made ridiculous amounts of money out of this.
Because, I mean, we talked about him as being this anti-establishment figure, someone who basically hates the fact that football has gone away from being a game to becoming an industry. And yet, he made his teams absolute fortunes. You know, going back to, I think, what, more recently, Marquinhos, who was at Roma in that year, his 1 year there, who was then sold after what being bought for $300,000 to Paris Saint Germain for what, $32 million or something.
What about how much money he made Pescara when he went there with Immobile, Insigne, and Verratti as well? So Signori then makes the move. Is the next one to go, and it's still a decent season that he has. It involves actually a 4-1 victory over Signori and Lazio, again at the Zaccaria. But his success, and I think possibly that victory there, was enough to earn him himself a move to the big club. And finally, the chance that so many people have, the big what if that people have been asking, what if you were to give an actual title contender to a man with these ideas, how extraordinary would that be? And we found out in the 94-95 season.
When I spoke to him, he said, you know, I didn't play a high line, because I just wanted to go and outscore the opposition. But I played a high line because it's a good way of defending, because the opposing players go offside, and when they go offside, then they can't shoot and score against you. Defensively, I don't, this idea that his teams couldn't defend or whatever, I think is a myth.
Well, and it was recognised by Lazio and then subsequently Roma. And it, although there is a kind of a notion that Serie A was very conservative in the 90s, it's extraordinary to see a man like Zeman, with his track record of kind of massive blowouts as well as great successes, being given the keys to one of the most expensive squads in the world at that point, that Lazio team. A Lazio team which hilariously involved Paul Gascoigne and a player less suited to Zeman's ideas. Hard to imagine, really.
No, but I mean, again, when you talk about that athletic preparation, there's that story about his first pre-season with Lazio. Lazio think it's a good idea to get the kind of club suits sort of tailored before they basically go away for their summer training camp. Obviously, clearly unaware that this guy works his players so hard that, you know, come the start of the season, those suits are not going to fit anymore. I just think that... It's funny, that Lazio team, yes, Cragnotti spent a hell of a lot of money on it, but they did seem to go through, looking back on it now, they did seem to go through sort of boom and bust, you know, in terms of that they would assemble the team for a couple of years, it would look really strong. Mm. Then they would get rid of a number of sort of, I think in his final season, they got rid of the likes of Aaron Vinte, obviously Signori had gone. Mm. There was a reason why, for example, I think they wanted to get rid of, they were going to sell Signori and Casiraghi at the time. And there was obviously the protests outside the Cragnotti's office, because I think, you know, they needed to sell to kind of really balance the books.
And, right.
You know, obviously their luck ran out in quite a spectacular way, sort of.
A
few years down the line.
Mm. That first season, though, that he was there, they finished second in Serie A. Mm. The following year, a third place, and just incredible results along the way. 7-1 against Foggia, which saw a hat-trick from Alan Boxic. Admittedly, Foggia were down to 10 men, but still just lads, you're running.
7 goals in 45 minutes, all in the second half, which even with 10-11 is quite something, because I think Zeman would lose a derby with Roma a couple of years later, even though Lazio had were down to 10 men after 8 minutes, he would still lose 3-1. So.
Incredible, huh? They beat Juve 3-0, the first time that Lazio had beaten Juve in 31 years, and then they went and did it the next year as well.
Yeah, and by the way, that was the Juve team who were defending champions. And who would
managed
go on
by
and
future
win
Italy manager Lippi, featuring future Italy manager Conte.
That's right, as well as three guys named Viali, Ravanelli, and Del Piero up front. Fairly, Didier Deschamps, I think, was in was in midfield, and it was stunning stuff. But again, to give you an idea of how that game panned out, it was 4-0, and Juve hit the woodwork three times. They had a ball cleared off the goal line. It's games like that that made you watch, like, wow, this is special.
Yeah.
You know?
An 8-2 against Fiorentina in March 1995, a 6-3 against Sampdoria that same season. But at the same time, in that campaign, and I think this was one of the nails in his coffin at Lazio, that game against Tenerife in the UEFA Cup, which became legendary. Lazio had won the first leg 1-0 at the Stadio Olimpico, then taking on a Tenerife team managed, Gabriele, by Jupp Heynckes. And
who's he?
Yeah, exactly.
It's amazing. Wonder what he got up to after that.
And I mean, this game goes back and forth, but the gist of it is that on aggregate, Lazio are 3-2 up, having scored two away goals, and then 4-3 up, having scored three away goals, and it's in the bag. And they still contrive to go out 5-3 because they will not stop attacking.
Mm. And there's a kind of urban legend about this game that when he goes to Roma, they're in the market for a centre back. And Zeman basically says, "Oh, that guy played against Tenerife a few years ago. He was really good." And they're like, "Do you have his name?" And he's like, I think it ended with a Z. And they had two centre backs whose names ended with a Z: Cesar Gomez and Pablo Paz. And Roma ended up coming back, signing Cesar Gomez, and it was actually Pablo Paz that he wanted, and Cesar Gomez was one of the worst signings in Roma history. I think he made his debut in the derby. They got absolutely smashed.
So Roma made that signing on the basis that it was a player whose last name ended in Z.
Yeah.
So anyway, the dream ends. And in, I think, January, after that Tenerife match, not long afterwards, he's fired. And Dino Zoff came back in at the point of business.
Right. There's a great classic Zeman in the weeks that follow, because he keeps going to watch Lazio. Because, I mean, he lives in Fleming, which is near the Estadio Olimpico. And he would keep showing up in the stands. And the fans didn't want him to leave in the first place because they loved his football and applaud him. And he was asked, you know, why do you keep coming to Lazio games? And he was going, well, you know, you all keep telling me that that my Lazio team defended so badly. So I just wanted to see where I was going wrong, you know, and that sort of thing.
Well, what happens next is pretty bizarre, because having been fired by Lazio, kind of the last thing you'd expect is that Lazio's biggest rivals would then pick him up. But that's what happens in the summer. Roma decide to sign him and again give him the keys to the kingdom, and a young but very exciting team that features, or will once Zeman's got his hands on it, Francesco Totti.
Yeah, who really, I suppose, took off under Zeman, even though he'd been given his debut under Vujadin Boskov, and then had been sort of protected, played, nurtured by Carlo Mazzone. Totti really sort of begins, I suppose, to fulfil his potential under Zeman, playing on the left side of that 4-3-3, because in theory he could get a little bit more space out wide. And yeah, even though he didn't explode in the way that we saw him under Spalletti when he won the Golden Boot, this was a player who was beginning to get into double figures quite regularly. And was
who else was in that Roma team then? Was it Del Vecchio? It was pre Montella.
I mean, compared with Lazio, some of the players that they were signing are just absolutely terrible. I mean, we told about Cesar Gomez. There was one summer where he was like, I really need a striker. Can you get me Signori? And they were like, no, Lazio are not going to sell a Signori. And so they were like, well, okay, well, what about Pippo Inzaghi? And apparently Sensi did not get on with Moggi at that time, so that was a no-go. Well, can we get Sheva? No, he's too good. Milan have already got him. What about David Trezeguet? That's not going to happen. And they end up with this guy called Gustavo Bartelt, who again just flops dramatically. And it's just, I mean, some of the players that they were signing in those days were just, even compared with their crosstown rivals, it's just like.
And Bartelt wasn't even, though, because there was the other Joao.
Was it Fabio Junior? Do you remember Fabio Junior? The other Ronaldo. Mm. He's going to be better than Ronaldo comes, flops massively. Yeah, it's.
And despite that, Zeman still gets them fourth in his first season, fifth in his second, before the club decide to bring in kind of a blue chip Scudetto winner in Fabio Capello. Now, we mentioned before the fact that his comments while Roma manager about Juventus, which led to a court case, which led to threats of legal action from Del Piero and Vialli after Zeman called into question how exactly they'd become so muscular, the impact that had, and maybe that had a role in his departure from the Giallorossi. I always thought it was just that they went, look, this is a romantic ideal, this is a fabulous way to run your football team, but if you want to win a title, Capello's the man to do it. But Zeman specifically cites that as the reason that his career went off a cliff after leaving Trigoria. I trained in Pisa until 1998, considered to be one of the best in the country, if not the world, and then my career was almost over because of my comments. Essentially, we talked about this at the top, took on the mighty Juventus when he was asked by a Spanish journalist what he didn't like about football, and he said the use of pharmaceuticals. Now, he says, and he actually said this in court when the whole Calciopoli trial happened years later, he said, listen, I've been dismissed many times in my career. Only one of them was a genuine dismissal. It was Lazio. But what happened post-Roma, Napoli, Salerno and Lecce, that was all because Juve put the word out, nobody can touch this guy, we want him out of the game. And although you might feel, especially given this record at some of those clubs, that the dismissals were justified, it's really interesting that in that same trial, the Bologna owner Gazzoni says that he was thinking of bringing in Zdeněk Zeman to the club, and he ran the idea past Giraudo at Juventus, which is a kind of bizarre idea anyway. But as he puts it, Gazzoni, Juve were a powerful club and I didn't want to do anything that disrespected them. So I asked Giraudo what he felt, and Giraudo let it be known that he didn't think there was any need to bring Zeman to Bologna. So I decided to leave it at that. It's a remarkable portrait of the way that that whole system ran.
Juve at the time, obviously, and even today, they have a lot of players under loan, on loan. You had Moggi and his son, who, you know, they had a player agency. They had a lot of influence among certain clubs.
They influenced everything. I mean, it wasn't just clubs and players. It was managers. It was even journalists who would be sure not to say anything to upset Moggi.
Well, because some of the intercepts that come out after Calciopoli, you hear Moggi with Aldo Biscardi. I think after one of the Domenica Sportiva or something like that, and they are just absolutely slating Zeman, hammering him in really not nice fashion, you know, saying, you know, what record is he set this time, record of being sacked. And part of the testimony that that Zeman gave at that trial, I mean, he tells this anecdote where, you know, he goes from Napoli, I think, to Salernitana.
Napoli, where he lost it, I think, was it 9 games or 7 or something like
that? And he says the sporting director at Salernitana said, oh, yeah, well, that was all arranged, wasn't it? In so far that, you know, Moggi got together with the president of Napoli of the time. It was all just a big plan to destroy you in that basically this would be your last chance at a big club. And, you know, the fact that you were going to get sacked after 6, 7, 8 games was all prearranged in that it was basically just to ruin his career. That was his allegation. You know, he again, I think, then went to work with Avellino. And I think Avellino at the time were owned by Pasquale Casillo, his former president at Foggia. And he claims again that Casillo was told by Moggi, because they were in trouble of going down to the third division, I think, at the time. You know, if you keep Zeman, you'll go down. If you get rid of him, you'll survive. Things like that.
It's sort of weirdly prophetic.
Yes.
Yeah.
By the same token, it's kind of like, to make an analogy in present time England for some people, it's like if somebody were to say, if you keep Alan Pardew, you're going to go down. You know, I mean,
That's quite damning. Alan Pardew is a comparison you want to make.
But what I'm saying is these notions become self-fulfilling prophecies. And I can take Zeman, I can see Zeman's side of it.
Mm-hmm.
I can also tell you that you could also go back to the 98-99 season where there was a sea change at the club, obviously Franco Baldini coming in, and Zeman being actually difficult to deal with. But also, if everybody around you is putting you down and making sure you can't get a big club, and you kind of wonder, you know, why don't you, are you glutton for punishment? Do you really think that, you know, a near bankrupt Napoli is where you're going to jumpstart your career?
Well, he did go abroad after that. He goes to Fenerbahce.
Yes. It's a calm, stable environment. Really, I can think a few places better to go and restart your career.
So his run after Roma, basically 19 years, 15 changes he made, including returns to Roma, 2 spells at Pescara, which I guess is probably the best bit of the first time around, the best bit of that kind of post-fall career.
Yeah, I think to some extent he resurrected his career, or again began to capture people's imagination again with that Pescara team that he had in the second division, where, you know, he was always a big sort of believer in Lorenzo Insigne. He'd had Insigne in his third spell at Foggia, and basically loaned him again when he was at Pescara. Did the same with Ciro Immobile, and you know, was the guy who sort of, I don't think he changed Verratti's position in the same way that Mazzone did with Pirlo all those years ago. But again, all of a sudden, this very promising player who'd been talked about for years starts playing to that kind of potential, to the point where PSG paid 12 million for him. 18 had never played in Serie A, and that team was just an absolute joy to watch. They scored 90 goals.
Yeah. 90 goals, conceded 55, but still plus 45 goal difference. Oh no, plus 35 goal difference. Still impressive.
But I mean, he won the second division, maybe 2 or 3 times. Yeah. And, you know, one of his explanations for that was like, well, that's where you play football. in Serie A, it's all about business. It's not about football.
I do also wonder to what extent we would have had Calciopoli, to what extent the magistrates would have been going after Juve had it not been for Zeman in kind of the late 90s, just being the first guy to stand up and go, hang on a second, Juve are not doing things by the book. And that first set, because it was the same PM, it was the same magistrate who was involved in the agricola, the pharmaceutical business, who then instigated and then followed up on the wiretaps that led to the whole Calciopoli thing 8 years later.
Well, I think the thing is the context. Before he basically gave that interview to L'Espresso, where, you know, he basically said, it's a little bit odd to me that, you know, a goalkeeper who's 28 all of a sudden is, you know, his glove sizes go up a bit, you know, and he
if the glove fits.
Well, it didn't anymore. That was the problem. But he was, you know, he'd been talking and talking before this by, you know, he'd be asked questions about, for example, the designation of the referees, how it wasn't fair, how the fact that, you know, I think one day a reporter put it to him, you know, do Juventus win because they're a great team or they get great favours as well? And he was like, well, can it not be both? You know, so he'd been, I wouldn't say.
Yeah, he'd been poking for a long time.
Right.
And, you know, I think now, years later, I think the perception that a lot of people have is that it wasn't just a big evil plot. It's that everybody was angling for favors. Everybody was putting, or almost everybody, certainly Inter Milan were as well, as we later found out with Facchetti, were putting pressure on referees and so on. Everybody's trying to get an edge. It's just that Juve were better at it.
For all of this, and his career has tailed off in a dramatic fashion. He's 70 now. Yeah, it's a shame. I don't know. Are we going to see him again? He came back to Pescara, opened up with a 5-0 win, brilliant. But it seems like the success was sustained even shorter this time, and he was fired earlier this month. It's always a shame when he goes, and it's always great when he comes back because you just dream again. Wow, is this going to be the time?
Yeah, I mean, that's his entire outlook on football is a very simple one in that, you know, if you give someone a child a ball, the first thing that they'll do is they'll run and they'll shoot. You know, if you give a child a ball, his first instinct is not to go and man mark someone. which, you know, is entirely right. So yeah, it all comes back to that, I think.
Beautiful. All right. Well, one or two other things to talk about in this edition of Golazzo. So we'll get onto those after this.
Listeners, if you want to combine your knowledge of the footy with your knowledge of the footsie, then you need to get yourself over to the football stock market, Football Index. Football Index is a new way to profit from your knowledge of Serie A, the Premier League, and beyond. Buy and sell players, build a portfolio, earn dividends, and sell at a profit. Because you listen to Golazzo, you can try Football Index and trade up to £1,000 entirely risk-free. Just head to footballindex.co.uk, enter the promo code TOTALLY, and if you don't love Football Index, you'll get a full refund with their 7-day money-back guarantee. Download the app or play online at footballindex.co.uk and become a football trader today. T&Cs apply. You must be over 18. Deposit required. And please trade responsibly.
Wow, how about this for a gear change? Zdenek Zeman, Zemanlandia to Di Biagio Landia and the new look Azzurri. We've had two Italy games since we last spoke. The 2-0 defeat by Argentina, and of course the 1-1 draw, Italy rescued by a penalty. L'Italia che va, as this morning's Gazzetta has it. Briefly, any thoughts on the new look Italy, on the steps forward that the Gazzetta certainly says that they made in Tuesday night's game with England?
These are friendlies. The results are irrelevant, especially when you're not going to a World Cup. I thought they had 20 good minutes at the start of the second half against Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, Argentina simply have far better players, and Italy didn't perform. Against England, I thought they kicked it up several notches. You know, if Immobile doesn't squander three chances early on, maybe the game turns out differently.
If Parolo and who was the other player on the free kick?
Rugani.
Yeah. Rugani.
Yeah, no, look.
What are they looking at?
Ultimately, you know, you look beyond the goals, right? Because you've got a controversial penalty in Italy score, and the other one is you have a communal brain fart, and Jesse Lingard's clever and takes advantage of it. Look at the way they performed on the pitch. I thought there were a lot of positives. For me, actually, I know Rugani got slaughtered by some for that, but take that moment out of it, and I thought he played really, really well.
Apart
I thought
from Pellegrini that, Mrs. Lincoln, really how well. Did you feel about the play? Sorry, James.
Sorry,
I said, apart from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you enjoy the play?
I don't think it changes anything at the end of the day. To some extent, I was encouraged by the performance, but I think that it shows that there's no real quick fix there.
And the players.
Well, although there is a really good talent base there, it's just that he seems to have, you know, bar two or three players, it's more or less the same side that Ventura played.
Right. And Insigne, who was the big, who was conspicuous by his absence against Sweden, didn't exactly justify his inclusion with that miss against Argentina.
No, I think, to be honest, it's clear with not just him, but Jorginho as well, that, they're in such a highly coached side with Napoli, where they have all these very precise mechanisms. They, you know, they don't really have to think about it. It just comes off, can do everything by heart. When you take them out of that, you know, I think it's going to take a hell of a lot more work, really, to get them to perform as they do for their club, for their country. Really. Mm.
Do we know who's going to be the next Italy manager?
Apparently it's going to be announced on May 20th.
May 20th, yeah. All right.
I don't know why that date. Why? Like, you know. I mean,
why would you say that? Unless you were really... I mean, well, May 20th is the day that...
Does the Russian season end that day or something?
Sadly, yes. No, but May 20th is the day by which every UEFA season has to be over, right?
All right, so maybe
the Champions League final. So that's the day that, you know, Conte might become available. It's the day Mancini might become available. There's a school of thought that... I don't know what you think. I don't think they've have anything in the bag because they're incapable of keeping anything secret. No, but I think maybe by that, maybe they figure out by that day, maybe then we can announce Mancini, or maybe Ancelotti won't get another job and maybe we can rope him back in. If we don't get anybody, let's just continue with Gigi Di Biagio. Mm. You know, I really think that's the idea.
Who learned his trade and is then examined at Foggia.
There you go. It all ties back.
Full circle. All right. Now, this weekend, we've got a marathon of Serie A for you. If you're anywhere near a BT Sport-compatible television, Saturday morning, it all begins with a Gazzetta Football Italia. Can't see that title sticking. But anyway, 10:45 Saturday morning, previewing the day's action, it being Easter, all the games being played on the Saturday. And Gabriele and James, you're joining me for that. That's going to be very exciting. We've then got... big games coming up. Roma at Bologna. That's 11:15 on Saturday morning.
Yeah, Di Francesco going up against his son.
Wow, what a narrative. Mm. Well, you can tell us more about that in Saturday's Gazzetta Football Italia. Then there's other games going on in the afternoon, including Der Klassiker, Borussia Dortmund against Bayern Munich. But the big one for us is at 7:30, Juventus taking on Milan. Of course, this is against the backdrop of the only title race in Europe. Juventus, who are 2 points ahead of Napoli. Napoli, meanwhile, are visiting Sassuolo, who just ended it. They were on a terrible run, but they ended that last round with a win at Udinese. So this is a huge match for Juventus. If they slip up here, Napoli can go back on top, or at least pull level. And, of course, it's Juve-Milan, so that's just massive.
And, of course, it's the first time that Leonardo Bonucci will be playing against his old club, Juventus.
Wow. And, of course, then, not long after that, a week today, in fact, Juve will be taking on Real Madrid in a rematch of last year's Champions League final. Wow, might talk about that next Wednesday in Golazzo. But for now, many, many thanks to Gabriele and James. And from all of us here, it's arrivederci.
You've been listening to Golazzo, the totally Italian football show. It's a Muddy Knees Media production, and for sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com.
My name is Matt Davis. You'll have heard me on the Totally Football Show and Gorilla Position. And for those of you who enjoy your talk about spandex screw jobs and cheap pops as much as your discussions of the Premier League, the Champions League and beyond, then here's some news to brighten up your road to WrestleMania.
Ooh, yeah.
I've hurled the jabroni who used to host the Parts Unknown Wrestling Podcast through the barbershop window so that we can begin a new era. New guests, new music, new gimmick, new spandex. Parts Unknown begins on the first week of April with our WrestleMania preview show. And once we're done reviewing it 7 days later, we'll begin breaking down all the previous Manias from 33 to 1 in our WrestleMania Rewind.
Here we go!
We'll also have interviews with WWE superstars past and present and analysis of the current pay-per-views. Sound too good to be true? Oh, it's true. It's damn true. So, if you enjoyed Parts Unknown before, consider this reboot the Ringmaster becoming Stone Cold, Husky Harris becoming Bray Wyatt, or Kane becoming the Mayor of Knox County. The Parts Unknown Wrestling Podcast, from the people who bought you the Totally Football Show. Subscribe now on Acast, iTunes, and everywhere else you get your podcasts.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.